Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Artificial intelligence and other forms of automation are on the horizon for a lot of different industries right now. From self-driving cars to robot factory workers, AI is coming. And it could have a huge impact on jobs in this country. That, combined with global trade and the political pressure surrounding labor unions, creates a lot of uncertainty for the future of work. What does labor look like in 21st century America? Crosscut invited a panel of labor leaders, scholars, and disruptors to offer insights and predictions. Meenakshi Rishi is a professor of economics at Seattle University. Her work focuses on international finance, energy economics, and entrepreneurship, among other topics. Orrin Cass is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His research on strengthening the labor market addresses issues such as environmental regulation, the social safety net, and higher education. David Rolfe is founder and president emeritus of SEIU 775 and a former vice president of SEIU International. He helped lead the nation's first two successful campaigns for a $15 minimum wage. Caleb Weaver is the public affairs manager for Uber in 12 Western states. He and his team work with policymakers to develop regulations for Uber and other transportation network companies, and they engage with community leaders, legislators, and the press. Monica Nicholsberg is the civic editor at GeekWire, where she covers the intersection of tech and politics. She moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and WeWork. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Well, thank you all for being here. I know it's not easy to be inside on a day like this in Seattle, but we're here to talk about a really important topic, the future of work. We've got a pretty diverse mix of panelists here, great mix of experts to bring some different perspectives to this topic. So I thought that it would be fun and kind of revealing to start by talking about the best and worst case scenario when we think about the future of work. What's the utopian vision and what's the dystopian vision? So maybe we'll start down the line with you, Caleb, and just hear what everybody has to say.
Sure. Thank you all for being here. It's a real pleasure. Thank you to Crosscut for putting together a panel on a topic that really consumes a great deal of the work that I do at Uber, which is thinking about how do we improve the quality of work? How do we work with government agencies, worker organizations, and others to continue to leverage technology to make work more satisfying, more rewarding, more dignified? And certainly from the Uber perspective, we believe that there is tremendous opportunity to continue to leverage technology to enable people to work in more creative, more flexible ways, to earn good money in a way that works for them. And we believe that there's going to continue to be new ideas that come up that we can't imagine now that are going to open some new pathways. And we certainly are committed to trying to do that. And that's the future that we believe is coming. I think there's alternate views, obviously, about widespread automation. And that's just, even with our work on autonomous vehicles, that is not where we do not see the end of human work under any of the scenarios that we're working under. So it's really hard for us to imagine that even happening.
So you only have a utopian vision for the future of work?
We just don't. If you look at history and you look at how technology has caused disruptions, but not put people truly out of work over the long term. And with our work and how we see our technology being able to improve the opportunities for a wide variety of people, we don't see it coming.
All right, I'm going to let you off the hook for that for now, but we might come back.
So I have to answer the same question?
Please.
All right, since I'm an economist, I'm going to give you a two-handed answer on one hand and on the other hand. Let me tell you on one hand, the present of work has never looked any better. Today's good news is that our unemployment rate in the United States is at a 50-year low at 3.8%. Wage growth has been at 3.2%, accounting for inflation at 1.9%. 3.2 minus 1.9 means the real wages in the United States are rising. So that's the present of work, which is today's data for the first quarter. But I'm not so optimistic about the long-term future of work. And there are four things that I hope come up in the panel, but there are four things that I would like to alert and draw attention to. One is it's a state of flux and uncertainty, the future of work. There's polarization between skills, between employment and underemployment, between cities and rural areas. So that's number one. Number two is stagnating incomes and disappearance of the middle class. Number three is a raging debate on migration and its impact on the future of work. And finally, as you alluded to, Caleb, technology and especially artificial intelligence and the rise of what some thinkers have called a useless class. If my job is going to be taken over by a robot who can teach economics, which I think anybody can, then I should have been in the plumbing business. then what am I going to do? So am I going to be a useless person in the future? So that's my two-handed answer to your question, Monica.
Thank you.
So, I think from a futurist perspective, you would say that we have to think about multiple utopias, multiple dystopias, and a range, not a certainty, around the possible future of work. Are we going to have, will the machines do all the work for us, create all the wealth that we can then harvest and share, and we can all spend our time writing poetry, playing music, and, enjoying our favorite TV shows, our family, our communities, our churches, whatever we do, is certainly one version of an extreme utopia. Unfortunately, the path we're on is far more dystopian. Over the last 40 years, we've seen more than $2 trillion a year of our national income repurposed from the big inclusive middle of the economy to the very top of the economy. The low point of black poverty was in 1975. The low point of inequality was in 1970. The net impact of women doubling their workforce participation between 1977 and 2012 was $0 in take-home pay for the bottom 90% of income-earning households. We've largely done away with the old pension system with a lot of what used to be job security. And it is easy to imagine a dystopian future where a handful of highly educated technical elites in finance and technology occupy all the wealthy urban real estate in the country and enjoy secure jobs with good benefits, high wages, earn equity for the contributions they make to growing our nation's wealth. And everyone else either works too little or too much on subsistence wages and lives a life of uncertainty, debt, and always staying at least one step behind where they really ought to be. And that is, we are far closer at the moment to being on the latter path than the former path. And I, of course, am an optimist because I believe that what we do matters, that collective action has an impact. And if I sort of have a overall message, it's not that we need to lose hope or assume that our sort of technological overlords have predestined for us a dystopian future. It's that, in fact, normal people, ordinary people working together can accomplish extraordinary things. Humans have had an impact on the future of work in the past. God didn't make automobile worker into a great factory job. It was a lousy factory job. It was dangerous. It could be deadly. It was low paid. It lacked dignity. And then humans intervened, government, labor, and business, to create a middle class in the heart of the 20th century. The challenge for us is whether or not there will be an inclusive and accessible middle class for the 21st.
Great answer. Well, as with most questions, I'm going to agree with half of what David said and disagree with the other half. I don't think it's right to picture a future where no one has to work because they're all composing poetry as utopian, because we know what happens when people don't work or have to work, and they don't spend the time composing poetry. I mean, we have a program in this country where you can drop out of the workforce and receive about $1,000 a month from the government, and it's called disability. And no one holds up our disability system as, like, that's really working and that's what we want to shoot for. In fact, we see that in particular men who drop out of the labor force do not spend more time caring for family. They don't spend more time writing poetry. They spend more time watching TV and sleeping.
Video games.
Video games is a subset of TV. And work, conversely, turns out to be incredibly important to people's identity, their self-esteem, their life satisfaction, to family formation, to outcomes for their kids, to the health of their communities. So I think the utopian vision is one where people are working and are able to find the kinds of jobs that David described in his second scenario. The dystopian view is one in which we create this increasing useless class of people that don't have a role in the labor market and do choose instead to support them through some set of transfer payments, which we are increasingly shifting toward doing and is not producing good outcomes. I mean, the funny thing about, you know, a starting point of 1970 or 1975 for things getting progressively worse since then is that's exactly when we began dramatically expanding the safety net and went from spending $250 billion a year on low-income programs to more than $1 trillion a year now in real terms. And that's not to say we shouldn't have a safety net for those who need the assistance. It's to say that's not the goal. The last thing I'll say about how we think about what's pushing us between those two outcomes, and this is where I'll disagree with Caleb a little bit, is that technological development can push us toward the good outcome, but there's nothing that guarantees that it will. We have this story in our heads that technological disruption produces all of these terrific things for society. It's actually a two-step process. You both need the technological disruption on the one hand, and then you also need a labor market and an economy and entrepreneurs who are coming up with new and better and more productive things to do with the disrupted people. And one reason we're drifting toward the more dystopian view that David described is because we are getting the disruption and we have lost the back half of that cycle. And so I think a lot of our focus has to be why is something breaking down on that side and how can we bring it back to support the disruption?
Well, we're going to talk about universal basic income, don't worry. But I want to back up a little bit and just kind of seize on something you said at the end there, because we are entering this era of incredible change in the workforce, as all of you have mentioned. You know, economists estimate that anywhere from 14% to 57% of jobs are at risk of displacement by automation. And so what can we do specifically as governments or the private sector or working together? What are some actual things we can do now? Because this era is already here. Oren, do you want to
go back this way?
We don't have to go in order.
I'll say something about it, which is that, first of all, the statistics don't suggest that we're in a period of particularly dramatic disruption. I mean, we have a very good measure called productivity that Bureau of Labor Statistics measures every month or every quarter and says how much more output are we getting with less labor, which suggests we're introducing technology or training or whatever it is. And other than this most recent quarter, productivity growth is at an all-time low. So we are not disrupting especially quickly, and we're certainly not disrupting faster than we did in the past. The feeling of disruption is coming from the fact that as disruption occurs, there is nothing new that people are moving into. The policy areas we should be talking about, first and foremost, I think, are an approach to education that doesn't focus on college. For people who want to go to college and can succeed in college, college is great, but that is not most people. And for the most people, we offer roughly nothing. And so investing much more heavily on behalf of the individuals in their capacity to be workers, and then conveying to the entrepreneurial community that there's going to be an invested in capable workforce to build around, I think is crucially important. And then along with that, I think we have to look at what are the policy areas that say, hey, business people, go work in a coastal city on tech and finance and not in the real economy making things. And that's an approach to regulation that says doing anything in the real economy with real people is going to be as relatively risky and unattractive as possible. It's trade and immigration policies that say we don't have any preference for you using the people who are already here, even though as a country we really should have that preference. And then I think we should talk about organized labor and not the 1930s style system that we have that is not working especially well at this point, but finding a new structure that is actually going to support workers and provide an infrastructure to get them into more productive jobs.
let's talk about retraining, because, you know, college used to be seen as this ticket to the middle class, this tool to lift people out of poverty. But it's starting to not look like as good of an investment as it once did. But government retraining programs haven't been very successful. A really low percentage of the people who are actually trained for new jobs get placed in them. So given that that's not working very well and college isn't working very well, do we need some sort of innovation in this space in order to actually move the needle? Anyone?
I do want to preface your question by saying that in all the good news that I pointed about the present of work, one thing that is actually not pleasant is the fact that our labor force participation rate is actually going down. And that has ramifications for gender in the workplace. Because by some estimates, and I did some estimates, and I'm an economist, I get paid to do estimates, 670 million fewer women are employed compared to men. If you look at a loss of output and see how much this translates to, it's a loss of $12 trillion, which is current GDP of Japan, Germany, and UK combined. So I think that in terms of retraining colleges and working, you said apprenticeship programs need to be revamped. I think the future of remote work needs to be rethought of. Remote work is no longer for people who are voluntarily sitting in their pajamas and logging in hours. It is now going to become a necessity for women, for people with disabilities that don't have to collect disability, but they can actually contribute remotely, for military spouses. And I think there has to be a rethinking in terms of engaging these remote workers. There are people who are taking care of sick parents, sick children, and are working at home. So I think the future of work from that regard needs to be more inclusive, diversity friendly, and we need to think strongly in terms of that. There is some research by David Otter who says that there are going to be three kinds of jobs in the future. One is, your machine analyst, data specialist, who makes about $25 an hour or more. The second category of jobs are wealth workers that cater to those people that are making these high jobs, these high incomes. These are people like life coaches. I thought somebody might smile, but nail specialists, personal life coach, that kind of stuff. And they make about 18 something an hour. But at the last mile, there is no future for the person who's actually putting the stuff you buy at Amazon inside the box. And they're making about 15 something an hour. And if you just look at how their incomes are stacking up, the person who's making 15 something an hour on current consumer price indices, actually making less than the worker made in 1970. In 1970, an average worker made $3.40 an hour. But if you look at consumer price index, they were actually making more. So I don't know whether education or doing anything to this last mile worker is going to help them. There are clear returns to education, but I think the emergence of the remote work possibilities and engaging people through apprenticeship and in internship programs, you know, the German style of vocational training, becomes engaging to my mind, at least.
So I want to make two points on this. First, that our system for training, at a minimum, training those who are not bound for jobs that require a college education is broken beyond repair to the extent it ever worked to begin with. At some point that system was called high school. And if you left high school and you knew a little algebra and a little English, you could get a job in a factory, and that job would eventually over time through seniority and advancement probably turn into a good job that was capable, that produced a single income that could support a single family in a single home. That is a status quo ante. But the sort of post-college workforce space and the post-college education space, post-high school education space in general, we have to appreciate was a system originally built for the children of British landed aristocrats in the 19th century and itself based on an earlier system for training Protestant clergymen. It has zero relevance to an adult learner trying to figure out how to navigate a complex workforce in the 21st century. And we need to think about a system redesign, really from using design and UX principles and understanding the problem from the learner's perspective, not from the perspective of those who run educational institutions. And that means thinking about not tying the ability to learn and get a signifier of competency, I won't even say the word credential, at a building, on a campus, in a place that requires an application and a registration and a fee and navigating coursework. We need to think about how do you make learning and skills acquisition and with real competency validation something that is far more open source, far more accessible, far more well supported, right? Because it's one thing to say, even if you say tuition is free for a trade school or an apprenticeship program or a two-year program at a community college, and someone still has to lose income. So a typical American worker now making $18 an hour has to lose income, pay for childcare, pay for gas and parking, or take the bus for 2 hours in order to access that ability to learn. We are creating barriers that are quite significant for the people who most need the ability to train and retrain over the course of a lifetime. So I think that it requires a level of investment, but also a level of system redesign that blows away the legacy of these sort of no longer relevant 19th century institutions. At the same time, I want to caution us against the error of educationism, the idea that education solves all problems. Now, I appreciate we're here on a college campus. I'm deeply grateful that my parents' own level of education and their incomes gave me the ability to get a great education at an elite private school on the East Coast, when even though I came from a pretty solid middle-class family in Cincinnati. If we design a system that where the only winners are the ones who navigate their way through a four-year degree or a graduate degree, we're going to be leaving, as Oren points out in his book, 80% of Americans behind. And the reality is there are plenty of countries in the world where your ability to succeed and earn an income as an adult is not limited to those who follow that single path. Some of those countries now have the world's largest middle classes that we used to have, while we've dropped down to something like number 27. So I think this sort of idea that education is the panacea is, and this is what, I actually disagree with almost nothing Oren said, but I do think, I'll use some language you probably won't like, but I do think it's part of this sort of neoliberal trickle-down lie that teaches us that if you're poor, it's all your fault, that there are no systemic interventions that we should make as a society to make it easier on everyone to be part of an inclusive middle class. And to use the automobile worker example again, but there are many others domestically and globally, it can't be true that the only good jobs are for those with advanced degrees. With my grandfather, in eighth grade education, dropped out to work in a sawmill at the age of 13 to take care of his 9 younger siblings when his mom died, and died with a house that was paid for, his kids had gone to college, there were 2 cars in the garage, his widow needed to go on Medicare, and that wasn't because he was a great innovator, owned intellectual property, a great investor, or had self-educated to the graduate school level. It was because he joined General Motors, went to work for the world's largest employer, joined a union that had the power to make them say yes when they wanted to say no, and existed at a time when companies and governments were investing in Americans, which is, I think, the critical difference between the economy that allowed him to earn his way into the middle class in the 1950s and the economy that young people are facing today.
And so I'm just going to actually build from what David said. I think one of the struggles that we feel significantly in our space at Uber is a regulatory structure that was built 50, 70 years ago for workers and how we think about work and how we think about the relationship between workers and corporations and labor organizations. And Oren alluded to this a second ago, but, you know, I mean, there's just these bright lines that exist. You know, you're either an independent contractor or you're an employee, and you fall on one side of the line, and we've been fighting about who falls on what side of that line for decades. And the problem is that unfortunately, the opportunities that David's grandfather had in that path aren't the same as they were anymore. So how do we think about creating a regulatory structure that actually opens that path or strives to open that path to other ways of work, that leverages new technology, leverages new opportunities, whether it's remote work, whether it's something like platform work, which we believe can continue to be improved. We're not saying, you know, from our perspective, you know, that's a lot of what I do. How do we improve the work that's available through companies like ours? We think there's opportunities to do it. That's why we're working with government, why we're working with labor organizations to try to figure out how we do that. Because right now, the regulatory structure that exists doesn't really open that path. And so when forced to choose, companies opt to one side of it. And I'm not saying that there aren't enlightened CEOs that maybe could go another path. We can argue that one out. But the reality is the incentive structure today is not set up in a way to try to push in that direction. And so I think we see a lot of opportunity there as well.
But you could make the case that disruptive companies like Uber are the ones who are driving this change, where a job doesn't mean the same thing that it did once. And Uber is actively fighting a Seattle ordinance that would allow Uber drivers to unionize for some of these protections that we've been talking about. So given that reality, what responsibility do employers or private companies have, and what should we expect from companies like yours?
So look, we embrace the opportunity. Again, we are not afraid of working with organized labor. I want to be very clear. We are not, right? That ordinance, well, no, we're not. We're not. Because we believe that organized labor can and should have a role in improving the work that people do. And we think that we see many paths where that is part of Uber's future. Now, the Seattle ordinance, I don't want to make this about Seattle's ordinance, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody afterward. It was a fundamentally flawed ordinance for a number of reasons. It was not created with the drivers. It was not created as a realistic way for that type of worker voice to be incorporated into our work. We believe that there's better paths, and we think that working cooperatively, I mean, and David knows the history of how we got to the place in the 50s, and it wasn't happy, right? It took a while. It was a period of disruption that had preceded that. But at the end of the day, it requires some degree of engagement from government, labor, and the companies. And you know, look, I think there's real possibility there, and we see that's going to be the future to making progress.
David, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't approve, just to be clear, I don't approve of union busting by anyone or any company. But I do want to note, and I actually know the history probably as well as anyone of how the Seattle ordinance got to be what it is and what it isn't. I actually think that we have to hold our labor organizations a little bit more accountable for their own failure of imagination. That simply repeating the same thing again and expecting a different result is rarely a strategy for success. And there is a tendency in any organization, labor, business, government, commercial, academic, for generals to fight the last war. And I think that the failure of labor unions to adapt to the modern economy, now you can say they had everything, all the money in the world being spent against them, the laws got stacked against them, I would broadly agree. But I think we're stuck in this, not uniquely, but peculiarly American enterprise style of collective bargaining assigned to the labor movement by Congress in the 1930s.
What do you mean by that?
That where bargaining occurs only between certified unions not even at the workplace level, but at the bargaining unit level. Right, which may be a full workplace, could be a full company, but literally it's up here the hill at Swedish Hospital. The nurses and the service staff and the dietitians all have different bargaining units. So we've got this sort of opt-in system where in order to get a union, you have to convince your coworkers, your employer, and your government not to fight you on it, and where all the incentives exist for companies, for reasons that are rational economically, to do everything they can to stop that from happening. So if what we wanted to see was more people covered under labor agreements that had the impact of raising wages, building more secure jobs, and raising the floor for everybody, that where, say, the choice of belonging to a union was individual, but the choice of coverage under a union contract was at an industrial or sectoral or regional level, so that we have a system more like Sweden's or Germany's or Denmark's or France's. Those countries have widely different levels of union membership, but they all have incredibly high levels of coverage under collective agreements that don't incentivize a race to the bottom. One thing I've never seen Uber try to do is get out of paying the tolls on the New Jersey Turnpike. because they have confidence that Lyft will pay the tolls, taxis will pay the tolls, limos will pay the tolls. You'll pay the tolls if you drive themselves. But if you say the reason bargaining worked in the middle of the century, because everyone is functionally covered, the big three autos. And if you're a union leader bargaining on offense today, I predict that a set of things are true. You've got association or pattern bargaining. You operate Taft-Hartley benefit funds, so the union becomes the pooled source of value, not just for the workers, but for the employers, right? And you functionally are creating minimum standards that the whole market has to operate in. And this is actually good for business, and it's good for workers. Workers get a better deal. There's less anti-union activity. There's more union coverage. And companies can compete on customer service, on innovation, on quality, but not on how badly they can screw their workforces. And the incentives are for collaboration rather than conflict. So if I had to pick a system, it would not be the U.S. system. I'll repeat one more time. You know, in the moments after the Second World War, a U.S. general governing Japan, General MacArthur, assigned something very much like the U.S. bargaining system to Japan. Another U.S. general governing Germany helped resurrect an older German system that was the privileged co-determination, which is, in other words, shared management of an enterprise, as well as shared governance of the firms, and broadly applicable collective bargaining that covered virtually everyone. Today, Germany is the country with the world's largest middle class. Japan has been through decades of economic stagnation. I'd rather be Germany, and so should any good business, because workers who are paid well make much better customers.
So essentially a level playing field.
Simply, yeah.
For companies, for everyone. Okay, speaking of a level playing field, Andrew Yang was in Seattle yesterday. He's the tech entrepreneur who is running for president on the idea of universal basic income. Every American gets $1,000 a month to do with as they please. Oren, it sounds like you think this is not the best idea.
I think it's a terrible idea. For a couple of different reasons. I think the standard objection to it, which is a good one, is that it's completely implausible and too expensive. And for what it's worth, that's true. So we should acknowledge that. There's a Canadian professor named Kevin Milligan is defined brilliantly what he calls the impossible trinity, which is when you're talking about a universal basic income, the idea of giving everybody enough money every month to live on, so let's say $1,000 a month in the U.S., there are three things you want to claim you can do. You want to claim that it's universal, everybody gets it. You want to claim it's a basic income, it's enough to live on. And you want to claim that it's not going to cost any more than what we do today. And you can do any two of those three. But you can't do all three, not even close. And as soon as you actually push on that and say, well, what are we trading off? Either you have to roughly double the entire tax burden. So instead of paying 30% of your income in taxes, you have to pay 60% of your income in taxes to fund it. You have to make it not actually universal. So that means we're going to phase it out and start essentially make it a benefit for the poor. Or you have to make it not a basic income, which means it's not actually enough to live on, which means we still need all of the other programs too. So there's that. When you hear someone tell you about a brilliant universal basic income program, figure out which of the three it fails. For me, you know, that being said, you could say, look, we should raise taxes that high. We should do it. We are wealthy enough as a country, therefore we should want it. And I think the more important problem is social or cultural, more so than economic, which is that it represents a very deep fundamental shifting of obligation in our society from individuals to the government. It takes the idea of work as something that you do because it is your obligation to be a productive contributor, to provide for your family, to provide for yourself, and says, actually, that is now the government's responsibility. We hope you'll work. We think it's a good, you know, maybe you'll like it and so forth. But the reason to do it is no longer because it is how you provide for yourself. And yet doing it to provide for yourself is exactly a huge part of the value that people get from work and what the meaning of it is in their lives. And so we can do as many sort of little experiments as we want where we pick a random group of people and send them the money for a little bit and see what happens. That's not a basic income. That's called a lottery, right? Government picks random people and sends them some money. We do that. It's called the lottery. You can like the lottery or not. It's not a basic income. The best indication we have of whether a basic income is a good idea is how people choose to raise their own children. Because every one of us, if you're a parent, has to decide which set of values I want to impart to my children. And most of us in, say, the top quintile of income, frankly, can afford to set up a basic income trust fund for their kid right now if they want. So if when basic income proponents all start doing that for their own kids and we all start thinking that's exactly how to raise kids, then I'll take the idea seriously. But until then, I won't. And we have to recognize that doing it is the equivalent of your crazy Uncle Sam showing up and setting that up for your kid against your will. Because you can't opt your kid out of it. He's going to get it. He's going to grow up in a society where it's there for him. And so unless we think that's the right way to run a society and raise people and set expectations, it's not a federal policy we should have.
Does anyone think it's a good idea?
Universal basic income?
Yes.
I don't think the government should abdicate its responsibility. I think it is the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. It is the responsibility of the government to take care. So I think you're setting it up as a individual versus government thing sort of muddies the waters, and I'm aware of the trilemma that you discuss, and I think I have like objections to that. You can actually get all three by doing some sort of progressive retaxation. And certain countries have demonstrated, Brazil, for instance, at the Bolsa program has demonstrated that they have had considerable success with universal basic income. I mean, I can disagree with what are the long-term consequences of the universal basic income, but I don't think in it as such, work is all individual and the government should have a laissez-faire approach. It has a responsibility to take care of its citizens. So that's my one disagreement with your assessment of the universal basic income. Do you want to talk more about this, or can I talk about something else?
You can talk about whatever you want.
I actually wanted to bring this discussion. It became about unions, and the unions have had a very sort of not a love-hate relationship with immigrants. And one of the things that concerns me is the future of work as it relates to migration. Economists obsess about the long run. Where are we going to be in the long run? And we want to leave higher living standards for our children compared to what we have right now. Yeah? Everybody agrees with that? Okay, good. So there's only two ways you can do it. You can make your workforce more productive, and two, you can add more people to the workforce. What concerns me about the United States right now is we are not adding many more people to the workforce as relative to our population. There are people that are discouraged in the sidelines, and there are people who are willing to work that are not being invited to become part of the labor force because of our asinine immigration policy. Thank you. Lin-Manuel Miranda said it best. Immigrants get the job done. Hamilton always gets a rise out of people, so thank you. And there are several studies, but what concerns me is how the idea of you, and you said it with Uber, The Economist is actually pitching unionization as a good thing, and The Economist is more conservative publication than you would agree with. So they're even pitching that unions actually do work because they actually raise wages, and higher wages are actually good for organizations and corporations because they become consumers, as you pointed out very rightly. So my concern is that as we go forth with the future of work, this battle is not going to be about how the pie is going to be divided, but is the pie getting any larger? And how does immigration figure in unionization? So I'm sorry I've hijacked it to this issue, but how do you figure that unions are going to be dealing with immigrants? Because when your grandfather's story was going on, they were hounding people out of Bellingham. They were telling immigrants to go back home and burning their homes.
I come from a union that has historically been a union heavily of immigrants, and that has taken sort of pro positions on the comprehensive immigration reforms that have failed in Congress. The union hall that my old organization occupies downtown, people on the staff there speak 14 languages. We teach our training classes in 14 languages. SEIU has historically been it was built by immigrant janitors in Chicago around the turn of the previous century. Equally, you have, the earliest labor history in Seattle was largely about gangs of white male workers beating up Chinese workers who were imported to lower wage standards and chasing them off to Tacoma because that was a lower wage market, right? So you've got some bad history, some complexity, and some angels and devils. But to the universal basic income question, just
bring us home.
You know, I've written generally favorably of it, not because I think it's a panacea, and I don't think it. I don't think you have to believe that work is going to be destroyed by machines to believe that keeping people that a basic level of income that keeps all people out of poverty is a terrible idea, or isn't it? Is a good idea. I don't think it's remotely sufficient. The $1,000 a month is not enough for a dignified life just about anywhere in the United States. There will still be incredibly high incentives to work. Most people work, to Oren's earlier point, work is a key part of human identity, a key part of how we are productive, how we form relationships, how we think about ourselves, how we find meaning in the world. And I think that work will not go away just because we have a sort of social insurance program to keep people out of the extreme and life-threatening poverty. I also think it has some value in tightening labor markets. So if McDonald's wants to bribe you to get burnt frying their French fries and put mustard on your arm until you can get home and put a real Band-Aid on it, that having $1,000 a month in income is not a bad basic level to make them up the price. All of that being said, this is not happening in the U.S. anytime soon. It is now exists in something that's close to a fantasy land of tech entrepreneurs hoping for some libertarian utopia where they can wash their hands of all other social obligations and civic obligations to participate in democracy and in the real economy. And so I think we shouldn't actually spend too much time on universal basic income. We should spend a lot of time thinking about how do we make the majority of jobs today, which are bad jobs, turn into good jobs so people can have security, stability, affordability, have the time and leisure to participate in their communities and their democracy, and, you know, spend a little less time on utopian Silicon Valley dreams and a little more time figuring out how the jobs we have now turn into the jobs we want our kids to have.
Well, I could talk about these topics, particularly Lin-Manuel Miranda, for another hour, but it's time to go to the audience Q&A. So the top question here, and if you want instructions for participating, they're right there, I believe, is what will Uber do for its drivers if and when it switches to autonomous vehicles? I assume that's for you.
I assume so. So we see autonomous as coming at some point in the future. And all of the models that we look at, we need human drivers and probably in much larger numbers than we have today into decades into the future. We do not see in any way the autonomous vehicles replacing the work that's currently being done. It may come at the expense of future growth, like the rate of growth in our needs to have more and more drivers working with us, but we really don't see it. Now that said, we have been very clear that we want to partner with government, with other businesses in our sector, and ourselves to support drivers with opening up opportunities, using the work that they're doing today to be a launch pad for something else, whatever that might be. And, we do see that as a responsibility of ours. And again, these are conversations that I participate in with some regularity.
Thanks. Okay. Disruption is a popular tech idea, but structural racism is very intact. How do we change that and ensure that our new economic structures are equitable? Softball.
I mean, I'll take that question. I think the important thing on that front to look at is trend lines. There are very serious problems in this country today with all sorts of things, structural racism included, but they are not as bad as they used to be. And, it was William Julius Wilson who wrote a very important book. It was in the late 80s called The Truly Disadvantaged, which basically said, we have to stop blaming structural racism for the problems afflicting particularly the poorest urban African Americans, because these problems have been getting worse exactly as racism has been getting better. And that's not to excuse the racism that exists, but it's to say that to focus on that as the explanation for problems that we have, and more importantly, the things that are getting worse and that we feel are the most pressing challenges right now, turns out to be, in a lot of cases, a distraction, and frankly, a very convenient distraction for exactly the people who are doing the best right now. So, like, if I were to speak to this crowd, I would say, if you really care about how well African Americans are doing in the economy, you should care a lot more about, like, reducing environmental regulations and eliminating NEPA so we get more infrastructure investment in construction jobs and development. You can go ahead and hiss. That's why the Council of African American Mayors wrote to Obama and asked him to postpone the ozone regulation when he proposed it, because they said it is not good for our constituents. That's just reality. Now, it's much easier to say, but I like my set of environmental priorities, so I'm going to complain about racism. And you can hiss some more if you want. But if you want to talk empirically about the things that are going to make a difference, there are things that are going to mean departures from your core preferences much more serious than just lamenting a racism problem that is at least directionally getting better over time.
We are out of time, unfortunately. But yes, that's what I've learned from the cards. But Oren is going to be signing a book, so you can talk to him more. We have five more minutes. Stay where you are. Okay. Well, in that case, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about the education system, regardless of budget, political feasibility, what's the single education reform you would make? Mina, you're in education.
He's anti-educationism. So, didn't you use that word? I've never heard that, educationism.
I'd never heard trilemma before, but I love it.
Trilemma is where there are three.
Economists love trilemmas. Everything's a trilemma.
Yes, economists love trilemmas because we love to complicate things. Wave a magic wand and fix the education system? Is that what the question was?
It's a single education reform, regardless of budget or feasibility, that you could make with your magic wand.
I would guarantee universal basic education. I would
that doesn't exist in America?
No. I would look at the quality of the universal basic education.
Okay.
It doesn't exist. There's structural inequities. Otherwise, how do you explain how... I have some data here. 90% of Fortune 100 companies have a chief diversity officer. Black men and women are only like 4% of that. Latinx folks account for 16.7% of the U.S. population, but less than 1% of CEOs at top Fortune 500 companies are Latinx. So, I gave some statistics on women already. So I don't think it's working. So I would guarantee universal basic education that works. Every child in school and learning well.
I think that sounds terrific. The reason I ask is because obviously we have universal public education in this country, and we've doubled per pupil spending on it in real terms over the past couple of generations, and test scores haven't changed. So I think we should do much better. I think that should absolutely be a priority for reform, and maybe in the spirit of waving a magic wand, we can just declare it will be better, but I think we have to have actual explanations for what is not working and what a policy change that would deliver a better outcome would look like. And that's where I think it gets a lot harder than it might look.
Okay, let's do one more. The onset of automation and AI will free up tremendous human capital formerly focused on execution. What will be the most important skills of the future? Should we all learn to code?
Actually, they say that coding is also going to be automated, so that's...
We're screwed.
That's not going to work. I think plumbing was a good for me. Even brain surgeons could lose their jobs to potential AI. I think certain things that require reading poetry and appreciating poetry, you mentioned that. That probably is a good job to have, I think that.
We should all be poetry
makers. No, actually, anthropologists or even archaeologists who have to like to dig into bones and look at a very minute level at Uber too. You know, when I call my Uber, that facial recognition, like, you know, you have a beard and you may not have it tomorrow, but how does the Uber driver recognize whether you're the person? AI can't recognize that. So a human being is required to make that level of discernment. So I think that those things are vital.
I mean, I think we don't know, and again, not being facile with the details. I mean, the statistics in the way that I should, but I mean, I think it's been widely publicized how, you know, an alarmingly large percentage of the jobs today like didn't exist or like weren't even imagined 15 or 20 years ago. And so, I mean, it is a fundamental challenge back to the last question about, you know, education. We don't know. And you know, people forget that Uber, we're 10 years old. And we started doing rides like 8 years ago. And we're brand new from the perspective of planning an education system, making large societal changes. And that's going to continue to happen. And so, you know, I think for me, it's about how do we enhance flexibility? How do we enable people to actually take advantage of new opportunities, build new skill sets, and have that safety net or the foundation underneath them that enables them to take that step? Because again, I think it's impossible to predict right now. And we have futurists that, let's be honest, like they're often really wrong. And you know, it's going to be our society's ability to keep up with those changes that I think is going to play a critical role in whether we do achieve the goals that, you know, I think a lot of us up here have been, you know, getting to. And, you know, it's, I think that there's ways to work together that we can do that.
Okay. Well, now we are actually out of time. If you take one thing away from this, it's to learn poetry and plumbing. Please join me in thanking our panelists for a great discussion.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.